Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It has been a bad beginning to the summer with ransomware and wiper attacks sabotaging PCs around the world. The WannaCry, Petya, and Xpetter invasions brought work to a standstill for individuals and companies, while the bad actors held information hostage. Restitution wasn't always possible depending on the attack, adding to the anger and frustration. Today on Town Square, we'll talk about cybersecurity, and we want to hear from you about your experiences and your confidence in preventative and restorative measures. Our number is 941-3689 on Oahu, 941-3689, 877-941-3689 throughout Hawaii and the mainland if you're listening to our live stream. Joining me today is Jody Ito. She's the Chief Information Security Officer at the University of Hawaii. She's responsible for the system-wide security and protection of information assets. She's on Maui this week for a three-day workshop with K-12 teachers about cybersecurity and to help them integrate security into their curriculum. She joins us by phone. In the studio, Jake Ross and Tyler Rouse are here. Jake Ross is president of Cyber Hui. It's a community of cybersecurity professionals dedicated to sharing skills and knowledge with Hawaii's youth. Tyler Rouse is a hard drive data recovery and ransomware prevention specialist. He teaches consumer computer security practices. He's also the lead developer of ShadowDisk, an anti-ransomware software using a patented stealth approach to security data backups. And, of course, you're here, too. Again, our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Welcome, all of you, to Town Square.
Thanks.
Glad to be
Aloha.
Here.
Thank you for having me on the show.
The attacks that we saw that characterized the beginning of the summer came thick and fast, but they weren't all the same kind of attacks, although some people tended to characterize them. So let's take it apart a little bit and just get everybody on the same page as to what happened. So I'll start with you first, Tyler, with what we began to see with WannaCry, which came to your office not that long ago, you said, with someone else who was still experiencing it.
Absolutely. WannaCry took advantage of an exploit that was found in Windows, which has been coined as Eternal Blue, in which case it allowed it to be able to take administrative rights and be able to wreak havoc on a system without any sort of limitations. WannaCry itself was not the first to use the Eternal Blue exploit. However, it did do quite a bit of damage, primarily because of the way that it reproduced itself. Any computers that had the Eternal Blue exploit that was still opened, meaning that they failed to do Windows backups in time for preventative measures, this ransomware itself could actually work over an entire network going from computer to computer and infecting all the computers in the network. One of the big stress points on this is that anybody that went into a coffee shop and wanted to use that local Wi-Fi, if there was an infected computer or a computer that was spreading this ransomware or malware, it could, in fact, be injected into an unprotected computer, even though you're not on a completely trusted network. That's one of the reasons why WannaCry was one of the largest attacks of this year and was very unprecedented. It really posed a lot of threats to that. And luckily, since we do have cybersecurity experts around the world that try to dismantle and take apart WannaCry, it was accidentally stopped by registering a IP address that the program was communicating with, inadvertently activating a kill switch that they had accidentally triggered when they registered that address.
All right, let's talk about what happened with Petya.
So like we're talking Jake. About, so thanks for having me again. So the Petya, like we talked about earlier, depends on if you have your tinfoil hat on or not, right? So there's a lot of people, there's a recent
wire. You better explain that.
So the tinfoil hat, if you're the big conspiracy theorist in the room, there's a recent Wired.com article that talked about the attacks in Ukraine against the power grid. So there's two attacks, one in 2015 and one in 2016, and it seemed like very targeted attacks against their power systems. They have it's a really good article. They have a video of the engineers on the computers, and the mouse is moving by itself, and they're kind of narrating like, oh, it looks like this guy's trying to turn this off. So these targeted attacks seem to be, like I said, targeted. They're very specific to an organization into some sort of technology, and that was kind of the trend in the Petya, where like 80% or 90% of the Petya ransomware or wiper or whatever you want to call it occurred in Ukraine. It wasn't we say wiper more than ransomware because of the way that it was put together. Like ransomware, you want it's like a pirate. Pirates want to get paid. The whole reason for ransomware is because they want to make money. There was no way for the author for the owner of this ransomware or wiper to get paid because there was no way for them to communicate via email to get their money via Bitcoin. So it was like a targeted attack, masked to look like ransomware, but it's very much. I'm not even sure how to say it. I don't know if you can kind of help me out on that.
So the Petya ransomware, a lot of security experts across the world are worried about that right now because this is not very typical for a ransomware creator. Typically, when they create a ransomware, it's going to be used with a set of randomized variables. And what this means is every person that gets infected is actually going to be told to send, confirmation of payment over to a random email address. Now, this random email address should be specific for every victim. Now, with this particular ransomware attack, it was only one email address. In addition to that, is that every victim should have also been subjected to a different Bitcoin address to send the money to. This was also not the case with Petya. It was actually one Bitcoin account. So because of this, there's only two possible solutions. One is that they're using a observer approach to see how people are reacting and what they're doing to try to combat. So that way, for the next attack, they can be much better prepared. The second is that this may be an amateur programmer that essentially took dozens of different ransomware variants, tossed them together to where they work together, and then they put it out there through what's believed at this time is still speculated. To be a Ukrainian tax software.
So now let's move to Xpetter, which was another variant. Jody, are you there? Can you handle that one?
Actually, no, not very well, because we actually did not experience any of the variants at the University of Hawaii. So I'm going to defer back to Tyler on that. So we actually have no personal experience with it.
All right. So anybody in the room here who can talk about what happened once this came to that next generation of Xpetter? Because on your point that maybe it was simply put out there to wreak havoc, maybe someone knew what they were doing or didn't and kind of threw this all together and created a monster. But with Xpetter, it seemed to be a little bit different than that.
Yeah, unfortunately, with our company, LifeBytes, and our development of ShadowDisk, we haven't actually gotten a hold of a Xpetter ransomware variant for testing yet. So we're not really too educated as far as that particular variant of ransomware at this time.
I think for like all ransomware, there are just several things you can do, and it's patch your computers frequently. For like the WannaCry ransomware, the patch was available in March, and WannaCry came out in May. So you had 2 months. You had 60 days of hitting like, no, I'll patch again tomorrow. No, I'll patch again tomorrow. So you had 60 days of that. And I know a lot of the cybersecurity community or the InfoSec community in general has an issue or a bad stigma of a public shaming, like, oh, you should have patched that a while ago. Why are you doing this? Why are you opening up emails from random dudes from Nigeria? Right. So but it goes back to patch your systems frequently, back them up. I mean, there's just
right. Well, we'll get to all of that about what you can do. But in terms of some of this stuff, you just brought up a really good point. Some of it is just pure common sense.
Right.
But very often that's what fails a lot of people and it causes a whole bunch of headaches. Jody, with the university, what were you looking at as these ransomware and wiper attacks began happening? And others that have happened beforehand.
So actually, we experienced different variations of ransomware. So as Jake and Tyler both alluded to, there seems to be a pattern where the ransomware authors really want to originally make money. And, we've had instances where they're very customer service oriented. They will tell you exactly what you need to do to be able to get the decryption key so that you can recover all of the information that was actually encrypted. So from the university standpoint, because what we really do is encourage our employees, faculty, and staff to actually do backups in a timely manner, the instances that we were actually infected with ransomware, we were actually to revert back to original states, prior states of the computer so that we did not need to pay the ransom. But what happens, again, is it's slight variation. So it's sort of like whack-a-mole, right? You're always trying to stay one step ahead of the attackers, but because they have the resources, the time, and they're getting very, very sophisticated, it makes it that much harder for us as the professionals to defend against this.
And I think that's the position that companies are in, that governments are in, that individuals are all in, too, because there's, as we talk now, somebody is developing something somewhere where we'll be talking about it as soon as that thing is unleashed.
Absolutely.
Which is to say that there's never a point of fail-safe.
No, there isn't. So for us at the university, our approach is about risk mitigation. So we analyze our digital assets, our networks, the information that we have to protect, which computers are used to access sensitive information, and we try to protect those assets in a tiered format. So the information assets that have the most sensitive information, those are the things that we will look at protecting the most with the most layers of defense, as you can call it that. And then, you know, other places, for example, maybe our student wireless network, while those computers are important to the students, they don't have the sensitive information that the institution has to take care of. So we may not pay as much attention to it. We do pay attention to it, but maybe not with the stringent technical defenses that we would place on other parts of our network.
Which might not be great news if you're a student and you end up losing some of your material, but we get your point.
Well, so what we do, though, is we educate the students and we have informational campaigns. We tell them that you do need to patch in a timely manner, that, you know, really they need to protect their information by having accounts on their computers with strong passwords. So we do provide a lot of informational awareness because they're the owners of their computers. The university does not own those assets. So they are responsible for protecting their computers.
Of course. If you're just joining us now on Town Square, we're talking about cybersecurity. No doubt that's come into your consciousness a lot more over the last month or so. We want to hear from you about your experiences, some of your fears about what may be happening, maybe some of your fixes, what you've been able to do, and how good are you about actually doing those patches when you're told to. We want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tyler Rouse says that we were listening to Jodito talk about what's going on with the university. And I said, so we're really never in a position of being fail-safe. And you sort of looked at me with, well, maybe so, maybe not.
Yeah, absolutely. So for a lot of these companies that are able to bounce back from ransomware right away, if you look at one aspect of it, which is just reducing downtime and being able to be in a position where you don't have to pay the ransomware demand, backups is going to be that number one option. So out of the companies that were infected with WannaCry, according to IBM, 100% of those businesses did have those backups. So if you look at the category of who was able to bounce back in under 2 hours, all those companies ended up having their own individualized backups. But it is important to understand that the way you conduct your backups makes a huge difference. Also is when you complete your backup, where is it stored? How is it accessed? That is another huge downside for backups if you don't conduct that properly. If your backup is still visible to your computer when you're conducting your backups or after your backups are done, it's still susceptible for deletion or encryption just like any other file on the computer. So paying very special attention to how your backups are conducted and being able to restore from those is critical to being able to bounce back from ransomware like that. Now, that's just on the reactive aspect. On the preventative aspect, having the updates, having a good antivirus or anti-malware program is critical to the prevention aspect.
I want to talk to you, though, a little bit about the differences, because when you talk about being able to restore, get back what you've lost, there still may be the probability that you are going to lose something, or you may lose a lot of something, depending upon what's come through. I mean, something gets wiping it. How are you going to get that back? And the fact that you may be promised, do this, pay this, you know, here's your little cyber currency, what we want you to do with Bitcoin or other, and then the expectation that you're going to get it back, only to find out that you're not, that it's gone.
Absolutely. So with ransomware, For those that are in the position that they're forced to pay the ransom, it becomes very tricky. Because when you decide that you're going to go ahead and pay that ransom, there is no guarantee that you're going to get that decryption code. Now, one thing with encryption is that, especially if it's a forced encryption without the proper permissions, is that you're going to end up with files that are corrupted during the encryption process. So with that, you know, it is important to understand that having your own backups independent of what was being recovered, you know, from the ransomware is very critical. And keep in mind that there are different types of backups. There's system backups, partition backups, file backups, differential, incremental backups. So the way that you have your backup set up is critical. If you have the space, I highly recommend doing a system backup. These system backups are going to back up everything that's located on the C drive from the very beginning of the drive to the very end of the drive.
Okay. We already gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves here. We'll get to some more of these fixes, but we have some callers on the line. If you want to join us, 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. If you're calling us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream, you can get to us live right now as we're talking about cybersecurity and what you are doing about it, maybe what you should be doing about it, or how perhaps it's impacted your life or maybe an impact you're yet to feel. Going to Anthony calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Anthony. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, how you doing? The easiest thing I do is I have a hard drive that is separated from my computer, and I turn that on, and then I just take all my information and I put it on that hard drive, and then I disconnect it from the computer again, and I just keep on doing my thing. And that hard drive is turn on, turn off. You have those. It's a very simple thing for me to do. And I do it once a week, and that's how I protect myself. I've had it twice already. I lost my complete system. My daughter lost hers. But we got everything back because we have it on a separate hard drive that is not on at all unless we're downloading to it.
Anthony, were you at all affected by WannaCry or Petya or anything else?
No.
Well, consider yourself a lucky one.
It's just that before this happened, 2 years ago, it happened to my daughter. 2 years before that, the entire hard drive was wiped out just because of I don't know what happened. But I've always, since then, I have a hard drive outside that I turn it on and I can download to it and turn it off. It's not connected to the internet in any way.
We got it. I want to ask those around the table, how effective is that?
I think it's very effective.
I mean, clearly for him.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, Anthony learned the expensive lesson of if you don't back up your stuff, you lose it all. So he's very diligent about doing it weekly and about backing it up offline and taking it, you know, and not leaving it connected to the computer. There's a World Backup Day, I want to say. It's like in March or something. So their mantra is like there's a 3-2-1. So you keep 3 copies of your backups, 2 of them at different locations and 1 of them offsite. And then that should keep you secure. I mean, keep you, you know, reasonably secure as far as your backups go. So if you lose, your hard drive dies, because hard drives are spinning disk for the most part, spinning disk break. If you keep it like online and on a spinning disk and on a thumb drive, I mean, that's some redundancy that you have, like keep in your pocket and be able to get back to your data. So, and it really depends on how important that data is to you. So if you lose your entire hard drive, I imagine there's banking stuff on there. There's probably some personal things, maybe photos. So it's how important is that data? If your business is your intellectual property, if it's your home stuff, is it like your banking, your wills, your any kind of personal information, and how much assurance you want to put behind that to protect that. So,
Jody, go ahead.
It's really about you know, how critical that information asset is to you. So that's part of our risk strategy, where those things that are the most valuable to you should be protected the most. In which case, you know, probably redundant backups, as what was mentioned, is very, very smart, right? So that if the first backup fails, you have a second backup to go to. And then that part about keeping it in different locations, very important. Because, for example, what if you had it in your home, but you had a fire at your home? Then you may lose that one. But if you had a separate copy somewhere else, at a friend's house or, you know, in your safe deposit box at the bank, I'm just throwing it out there, you know, then at least you have a second copy to go to. So, again, how valuable is that information to you should dictate how much protection and care you're put into creating those backups that you can then rely upon when you need it.
Well, Jody, you also brought up a point about having perhaps, you know, a hard copy of something somewhere if it's super important to you, that it exists someplace else and not necessarily in an electronic form.
Absolutely, right? So there are those pieces of paper that to me are still valuable because, for example, if I can't get to my computer, if the internet is down, I still have a paper copy that I can visually take somewhere, right?
Like your will, your trust, something where you might have to prove ownership of something,
exactly.
or to have the authority to act for someone else, maybe a power of attorney or something else that you need to show proof.
Absolutely. So those are the things, again, multiple copies, multiple locations, multiple formats is also very important.
Well, we've got you on the line now. I wanted to ask you about how you transmit some of this, you know, to kids, because you're working with teachers now who are K to 12, so very small kids and, you know, obviously high schoolers. Do they get some of this about cybersecurity and what they can do to enhance the chances that something that they care about that might not be super critical to obviously a government or a company, but something that they care deeply about might not be lost because they open themselves up to ransomware?
So actually, that's a very interesting point. And as the caller identified, that they really pay more attention when something has happened to them or their family.
Don't we all?
Yeah, right. And so, but if it's your friends that's now relaying a story, so we do this in our what we call Gen Cyber camps for middle to high school students. And we talk about the things that they have experienced related to cybersecurity attacks, which could be things like phishing attacks. It could even be things about cyberbullying. It could be related to things like posting inappropriate things online. But all of these things paired together, when they start sharing with each other and they realize it's not just them, it's somebody else, and it's a bigger problem, then they begin to understand what they need to do personally to protect themselves and their families and their friends. So it's, again, the more of an awareness we can get out there in the public, in the community, and have everybody sort of be responsible for their own cyber hygiene, as we call it, the better off we as a community, as a state, and as, you know, a nation will be.
All right. That's a good question to ask our audience. How's your cyber hygiene? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're going to go to Judah calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Judah. Welcome to Town Square.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Make sure you speak right into your phone.
Good. I'm doing that, and I'm driving, so I'm pulling over right now.
Thank you. That makes me feel better.
Makes me feel better.
Good.
So I spent about almost 20 years covering the media as a media trade journalist, writing for the business-to-business trade magazines in the U.S. and Europe. And as part of that, I cover the emergence of this kind of cyber crime, for lack of a better term. And there's a couple of things that people could do beyond what you've already said that might be helpful. Would that be useful to share?
Sure.
One would be switch to Mac.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I mean Apple world is a whole thing in and of itself in terms of how consumers have been at least given some of that message. Is that also true when it comes to protecting yourself?
Yeah, and most, because the Mac is the Apple is such a small percentage of the overall operating systems, very few of these hackers and scammers are going to take the time to write code that will work on a Mac. Although it does happen, it's not that typical. But if you are on a PC, some heads up that you might look for. Usually this stuff is going to come in through an email. There'll be some kind of attachment, usually, that they're going to try and get you to open up. And it's usually going to be something really plausible. And also there'll be some little threat of fear just to make sure that you get it. Very seldom will they use candy. It's usually a stick trying to get you to open it up. But what you can do is you can set your email program, this is on Mac or PC, you can set your program so that you do not automatically download any attachments. Attachments are downloaded manually
only
on command. Increasingly, if you get an HTML email, there might be code embedded in the HTML coding. In that case, you know, that's not so good, in which case I recommend that you find a really good email spam and virus filtering software that will catch a lot of this stuff, not all of it. But the main thing is, if you don't know the person,
or sometimes even if you do, if you just get a funny, fishy feeling in your gut, like, okay, maybe not. You know, maybe better to lose an email or lose a communication than to potentially put yourself in harm's way, which also goes back to the idea that if somebody is sending you something and if it's that important, pick up the phone and call them. I mean, simple stuff like that that could prevent you from having a real issue, that might be important. Judah, thank you so much for the call and for the tips.
I hope it's helpful for folks. Let me help.
Helpful is good. Thanks very much. If you want to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. It's a scary topic when you start to think about cybersecurity and the fact that there is no point of absolute certitude that everything is going to be fine with your computer, that you can protect yourself entirely, but there's a lot that you can do. The question is, are you really doing it? When you've been forewarned that there's a patch or something happening, do you really take that to heart? And are you also being smart about what you're looking at on your computer when you have email coming in? All of that, how are you with your cyber hygiene, as Jody Ito put in a moment ago? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We want to hear from you. So you heard what Judah had to say about that and the fact that, you know, people who buy an Apple system, and they do it for lots of reasons. You know, I mean, it's fun. It's got a lot of neat things attached to it. But it's also with this presumption that somehow it's going to be better or safer, which we just again heard from Judah. In your experience and having dealt with lots of people at this point, is that also your advice to them too, to switch over?
Well, I think Judah kind of alluded to the fact about like target surface. So Apple, although Apple is a very popular product, it doesn't own the majority share of the operating systems out there. So if I'm a hacker or a ransomware author and I want to make a lot of money, I want to hit the biggest target possible, and that's Windows operating systems. So I'm going to spend most of my time developing an exploit that'll get into a Windows operating system and that someone's most likely to pay. But if Mac OS becomes the most popular one, the majority share of the operating systems, I imagine we see a shift in the attack surface and more authors writing towards Mac OS. But right now, it's more of the economy of it. So that makes more sense for me to take the time to author something towards a Windows system versus a Mac system. That's my opinion.
Now, it is important to understand as well is that even though, you know, Mac is affected less because of their share of the operating system world, it is important to understand that there are ransomware variants that specifically target Apple as well. So just because you have a Apple computer does not mean that you're immune.
Yeah, don't get complacent.
Yeah, absolutely. You should still follow the same practices and the same computer hygiene, right, the cyber hygiene that was mentioned.
In fact, we had somebody who's just sent in something via a quick text message to me that saying that, look, we need a new word for this. We need to just call it Cygene and understand that we have to be responsible for that and take it seriously.
Cygene, I think I like that.
Yeah. I coined a new term here.
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
And thanks to our listener who just sent that in.
No.
So cyber hygiene, though, is the basic foundation for protecting ourselves. Bethan, as you alluded to, even receiving an email from somebody that you know that is just not feel right. You can get those funny senses, right?
Yeah, so pay attention to your gut.
Trust their gut, exactly. And because what happens, and we found this a lot at the university, is, and we call them phishers, P-H-I-S-H-E-R-S. What they're trying to do is to get our university community users to give up their university credentials, so their username and password for their email accounts, because then the phishers can log in to university-owned credentials and pretend to be, you know, university community members, which lends itself to a little bit of a broader trust community, right?
Right, so, and the phishing is no different than what an individual might be experiencing for someone who's trying to get their credentials for their credit card accounts, for
exactly.
their bank, for all of that, too. It's just at a greater magnitude because now you're talking about a system-wide key, if you will.
Right. Right. And then so therefore, you know, just because it's coming from someone you know, if it sounds funny, pick up the phone. Exactly what you said earlier.
Simple stuff, guys. Simple stuff. Okay, we're going to go to Avi now calling us from Waimea. Avi, you there?
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi there. Yeah, I just short comments. One, Microsoft, and I'm sure Apple does the same thing. They have automatic backups. Every time I turn on my computer, it goes to the automatic checking for patches and does that, and then I reboot the computer. So I always have a clean system. And I've also used like Kaspersky and Malwarebytes and run those every time I turn my computer on. And I've never had a problem with any kind of ransomware, malware, or any kind of that.
Oh, so, you lucky person, you. Okay, let's get some comment about that. You know, some companies don't want people to do this automatically. They want to do it system-wide at a certain predictable time. So it really depends on whether you're an individual, whether you're attached to a larger system. But what do you think about that?
Well, it is important to understand that the ransomware, the way that it works, is that it has a list of file extensions and areas of impact that it's seeking. So with that being said, Windows backups or restore points are commonly the first thing to go. During a ransomware attack. Specifically, since Windows, every Windows user has these functions, and since they're so heavily relied on, they do want to eliminate those avenues of approach that you can take in order to try to bypass their efforts. So using Windows backups, it is a great backup procedure, but still having it on a separate drive and plugging it after each backup is still a very prudent measure to take into account.
He also talked about a name that we all hear about, Kaspersky. And there's been some discussion about whether, you know, Kaspersky located where it has been and who was really driving it and, you know, what information may be kept, collected, what have you. But how safe, really, and how great are these different programs that people will buy to be able to, you know, put on their systems? I mean, especially for consumer stuff, not necessarily for a company or for, you know, a government, but looking at, and clearly that's being done on all those levels, but for individuals, how good should they feel about that when they buy Kaspersky?
I think Kaspersky is a good product. What they do in the back end, that's up for debate. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about that on how much Russia, the government of Russia, influences the company of Kaspersky. I mean, I think it was like a former KGB guy that runs Kaspersky. But, I mean, if you're the consumer and the product is doing what it does and you know, and he's happy with it protecting his computer and keeping his files safe, then, I mean, and there's not much – it goes back to risk mitigation and risk management like Jody talked about. Like, what's the risk to you as the consumer of the product? Like, for me, everything's great. My computer's backed up. My computer is protected. I mean, if the guy is doing something on the back end that may or may not be happening, I mean – I don't know if that factors into my formula, into the arithmetic.
Well, there's always that continuum is what I'm hearing right. You say, that it's never going to be, yes, it's great, no, it's not, but you have to look at what you're willing to trade off, what it is you think you're getting from it. Tyler?
So it is important to understand, though, that when you look at an antivirus, the common question is, which antivirus is the best? And the answer can never be black and white. The reason for it is because if you look at a sliding scale with 0 being functionality and 10 being security, and the closer that you push that ball to security, right, the less functionality you're going to have.
Right, so you have to strike a balance that works for you.
Absolutely. So every computer user is different. Some computer users do, very simple things that they can be more on the security side and not notice it as much. You could have some more advanced computer users that need to be more towards the functional side and are going to have less security. So depending on who you ask, you may get a different response based on their particular needs. It's always best to do your research before you choose a particular company, find out what they emphasize on, and be able to find out who has the best track record for your type of computer use.
We have someone via Twitter saying us, Jason Gestris was saying, I made a landing page for me to access anywhere. Can you break in? If not, it's pretty safe. What do you think about that?
If he's referring to a landing page as an HTML, it depends on how he's securing that page. For instance, a website is stored onto a server, and the server, any particular user trying to access that web page will contact that server and get the appropriate information back through the domain. So with that being said, if it's not secured by an SSL certificate or an EV SSL certificate, then it's completely relied on the security of the server itself But keep in mind that that server, its primary function is to give out information. So it's not particularly too secure in that manner.
Some people will say, well, maybe I should put a couple of these on. You know, maybe I have to get Kaspersky and I have to get, and then they just start loading their basket. And, of course, you could see the possibility for those things potentially thwarting each other, and that goes back to your whole issue about functionality.
Right.
What do you tell people when they start telling you, well, I'm doing this and this and this and this and those things where you're already seeing that there are going to be potential problems that they may not have even recognized yet?
It all goes back to risk management, right? So it's a lot of these products don't play well together. I went to some.
And they're designed not to play well together, clearly, because they want to share the marketplace. Right?
And plus, they all hook into the same file. So if I see product X hooking into a file and I'm product Y, I'm like, that looks malicious, or product and vice versa. So they just don't play well together. The best is to look at, I guess, it's operational impact if you're looking at it from a business perspective or like from the DoD. That's the way they look at it, is like, how important is operation or even like a hospital, right, for you to keep up your functionality, like how to, for you to keep up the CT scan running so you can have people come in there in the ER or the x-ray machines working? Is it more important for you to patch those things, you know, from a patch that's 2 months old, or is it more important for you to keep the revolving door of people moving, getting their x-rays and getting their you know, their stuff checked out as far as it impacts their health and their life, you know, true life and limb situations? So it goes back to that risk management, and it's a balance between education and awareness, right? Education is, what do I know? But the awareness is, how do I act? So you see, like, doctors that smoke cigarettes, you know, the education piece of it is like, I know I shouldn't smoke cigarettes, it causes cancer, but that doesn't change my behavior. And that's where the awareness comes in. So that same, I guess, analogy goes to security products. Like, I know I should be doing all of these great things, not clicking on these random emails, but this looks like a really good deal, and I should probably click on it to see if I win something, right? So it's how the... Does that affect your behavior? And those are two different things: education, awareness, and behavior.
Well, that's speaking directly to, you know, human behavior.
All right.
In general, and understanding that that's going to color how you are perceiving all of these things, which is to say that you can affect that if you choose to, like any of the other things that we've
talked
about.
And if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it.
Right. And then for us as humans, it's all about convenience, right? So if you look at our daily lives these days and the things we actually use on a daily basis, like our cell phones, we use them for our calendars, our email, communications, text messaging, basically keeping our lives up to date. We post pictures from Facebook. We use it for maps. But are we actually considering what information we're actually giving out by using all of those convenient applications? So for me, some of the other risk goes to these devices that we're connecting to our networks that we really don't understand the full impact on security just because of convenience.
Well, you're really leading us into a conversation about tracking. And obviously, when you are looking at buying something, information that's being collected about you, what you're buying, how you're buying, even, in fact, if you're not part of a rewards program, there's still information that's being collected about you. And also, if you have something on your car that allows you to find your car or connect your car, that's also tracking your movement, your habits, all of that. How comfortable are you, which brings us right back to some issues of privacy and security. If you're just joining us now for Town Square, we're talking about cybersecurity, and we want to hear from you. How much do you actually stop to think about how your behavior may be opening you and your whole system up to someone who may be trying to extort money from you or simply just trying to gum up your life? 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Okay, so we have a shy caller who said that people should know that at UH there's a Chinese language course, and it's taught by the Confucius Institute, and the homework is sent out via an attachment, and those can have viruses. Okay, that brings up a point. Jody, why would that be something that might not be good to do if, in fact, hackers might be able to get into some of that? For, and frankly, for any institution that's sending out information to its students, to faculty, to employees, and sending it via an attachment.
So absolutely. Attachments, though, is really a way of life, right? So people do it for convenience reasons, but also to share some important information in a timely manner. Now, so what we would recommend that people do is, if you're going to be downloading these attachments, make sure that your antivirus is configured such that it will scan the attachments while it's being downloaded to check for any types of malware that could be embedded in it. But again, that also means that you have to keep your antivirus programs up to date so that all the signatures are current. So it's, again, how do you configure your operating systems, your antivirus, and all of your other security controls so that you can try to minimize the intrusions or introduction of viruses or malware into your computer systems.
Jody, also, as obviously the UH is state-run, it's a state school, what if any, is there a conduit to state government? There are many people who are being asking about government being vulnerable through things like a state university.
So actually, the University of Hawaii, our networks and information systems are mostly disconnected from the state of Hawaii government. So we actually work as very independent organizations. So for the most part, things that occur in the state government don't necessarily translate over to the University of Hawaii, largely because the state government functions more as a corporation, so they have a lot tighter security controls around their networks and their information systems. The University of Hawaii, we are a higher education institution, so our mission and purpose is very, very different. We're about people being able to explore, learn new things, and it could even be things related to security research, right? If you're looking at viruses, what makes a virus bad, or how do they reverse engineer to learn more things about it? So these are things that actually we need to be able to allow within a university environment, hopefully within a very contained area in the university so it doesn't spread.
But not necessarily with a back door that leads into state government.
Correct. That is correct.
All right. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Have you checked your cyber hygiene or SIGINE lately? Are you concerned about this? We've just had quite a beginning to the summer with WannaCry and Petya and Xpetter, and heaven knows what is being developed even as we are talking now. Something is going to be coming down the pike. How aware are you of these issues that may totally stop your life and cause you a great deal of frustration for an hour, for a day, who knows? The point of it is, if you can do something about it, are you? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I want to go back to something that you said, Jake, a little earlier in the program, that, you know, the patch for WannaCry came out in March,
right,
and then we saw this whole thing blow up by the time we got into May, which is to say that even as we know there are things that are good for us and don't do, but in this case, this is not just something that's good for you. It's necessary and essential if you're going to keep moving and doing the things that on a daily basis you need to do with your system.
Right. All back to risk reward, right? So the patch came out in March, and for places like the National Health Institute, I think it was in the UK, that got hit really bad. Like I said, they have a lot of medical gear that requires things to be uptime, and for you to patch requires some downtime. So I mean, there's a cost, but there's a trade off there. And I'm sure that they thought that their systems were not affected. You know, they're physically separated, much like UH's system is separate from the state of Hawaii. So there's a lot of trade off that happens there. And it goes back to that SIGINE, right? I mean, I guess air quotes don't work well on the radio, but SIGINE, air quotes, it's how much are you willing to do? It's that those trade-offs, it's how much risk you're willing to put in. I mean, it depends on how big your tinfoil hat is, right? If you have a tinfoil sombrero and you run everything in VMs and you blow up your VMs at the virtual machines and you do all your email and banking and stuff through a virtual machine and you turn off your virtual machine at the end of the day and the state goes away, there's very little risk to you in the system.
As a consumer, but for security firms around the world, although they're changing hands, I'm just noticing that Symantec is going to buy Israeli cybersecurity firm Fireglass. All of those change in hands, and people are trying to enhance what they're doing by making their companies larger. Is that better? Is that, in fact, securing situations for both companies and governments better than people who are working more in isolation?
Well, people that are working in isolation as your standard consumer at home, their security protocols are going to be much different than what you're going to find in a corporation. A corporation is going to be using you know, user-end computers, commonly called workstations. They're going to be using servers. They're going to be, having a communication to servers that are in other areas of the country. Their requirements is so much more different than the home consumer at home. If you look at the list of the top five things to do to prevent ransomware and malicious software attacks, you'll find that there's only one or two commonalities between those, and the rest are entirely different steps. For a business, for instance, a business would go through and edit, Windows group policies. They would develop a whitelist to ensure that only computers that have access are going to gain access, whereas computer users at home are going to be using just an antivirus, or they're going to be ensuring that they're doing defensive computer use as their primary go-to. So definitely the approaches are much different to achieve the same level of security.
So what do you see on the horizon? I mean, the very near horizon, as obviously everybody has seen what has happened over the last month or two, clearly looking at trying to head off what happens next. You've talked about a lot about what consumers can do, but at a much higher level for governments, when you have things happening today in the UK and Russia, attacks that are going on, hacks that are happening all over the world, what's happening for the next generation of fixes for this, or at least preventative attempts?
Well, ransomware and preventative measures is always a cat and mouse game. The way that it works is Windows, for instance, they'll release an operating system, and there's going to be some issues in there that they did not foresee. It happens. It's a part of production. Now, when these exploits get found and they get released, then the software, ransomware or other malicious software, is going to come together, use that exploit, develop a way to infect the computer, and then they're going to initiate it. At that point, that's where it's on antivirus companies, Windows, et cetera, to turn around and come up with that fix in order to patch that exploit. Now, Windows does a pretty good job of making sure that they put out an operating system that's secure. Of course, hindsight's always 20/20. They can't fix everything. However, that cat and mouse game will always be there.
There used to be, back in the old days when you had burglars who would do all kinds of things to be able to make other people's lives miserable. But sometimes some of them would sort of turn evidence and show this is how we did it and this is what we're thinking. Are there any think tanks like this going on where people are routinely giving this information or saying, have you considered, did you look at it? Because sometimes you can be the victim of your own vision and your own, perspective on something, and until somebody else turns you around, this right. is, wait a minute, you forgot this over here, because that's what they were engaged with. Are there active groups like this which are working to help?
Absolutely. I think the governments, especially the FBI, has been wanting to get more engaged into this, and the hesitation from the public in general was like, do I really trust the government? Right? And that's kind of the thing. But there's also other innovative ways that people are trying to secure their systems, like bug crowding, like crowdsourcing your security. So it's like, hey, like the guy said, hey, this is my HTML site. Can you get into it? Companies will say, like, hey, this is my my product X, Y, or Z. Can you go try and get into it? And if you can, I'll reward you if you do it in a reasonable fashion and in a responsible manner. So it's really a win-win. It's like I get paid to go, quote, hack somebody's stuff. And then the developer, the producer of that product gets paid because everything he gets is a win. I'm not paying somebody $100,000 to go sit there and maybe he'll find something. It's like I'm paying somebody $20,000 and I'm sure that they found something that's valuable. So
which is to say there's opportunity in
absolutely.
This for people who are actively engaged in it. Do you see more people coming out of the woodwork or out of their basements or bedrooms to be able to help in this way and are doing it with a sense of purpose and, if you will, morality?
I think so. I think the term responsible disclosure is kind of like the buzzword among the communities. There's groups like HackerOne that have worked with the Department of Defense to do like Hack the Pentagon or Hack the Army. And it's like you register as a person who does penetration testing and then you hit a targeted system. And then you responsibly disclose this stuff, saying this is what I found, this is how I did it, and then you get rewarded. And it's like I said, it's win-win. It's like I can sit at home and do this and not have to put on an Aloha shirt and khakis and go to work.
But to that end, I would just like to ensure that the audience understands that there are responsible methods of doing that, as Jake just referred to, and there are ways that, just because a website exists and you go and try and do a penetration testing and you get in and you leave some evidence that says, hi, I was here.
Right.
Okay, that's not the appropriate way to do it, right?
Well, and that sort of goes back to a conversation that I know that you're having with teachers now, Jody, as you're on Maui and working with K to 12 teachers, because, you know, sometimes that's the fun of it, you know, for some kids. You know, the idea that they can somehow leave a little trace of, hey, I was here. They're not necessarily doing it to be responsible and to be helpful. They're right. doing it to, you know, maybe
it's
prank
fun.
A little.
It's fun. It's about reputation. Hey, I was able to do this, right? So I think we call it street creds that they're trying to earn in that respect. But remember that those sort of actions also impact you in your future, right? Because potential employers could see this as a negative trait. You're not willing to play within the rules, and you are willing to, you know, be on that, we call it a gray hat, black hat side of it, right? So those areas that are sort of outside the bounds of the law. So at that point in time, you know, in middle school, high school, we need to inject into the students this concept of morality, ethical, you know, legal behavior, and just tell them that things that you can do now could potentially impact your future. And it's simple things, even like what you post on Facebook or social media could affect you in negatively. For example, I believe it was earlier this year where 10, I believe it was Harvard students got their acceptance letters revoked because of what they posted on social media, having an impact now on a longer term part of their lives.
I mean, Jody, you said something a moment ago about we tell them this, but as we all know, at least those of us who have kids, you
Correct.
Can tell them all kinds of things, but it's until they get the real experience and perhaps even getting it secondarily from another kid mm-hmm. that they get the message. So how are you delivering this message in a way that somebody who is in middle school and high school, or maybe even younger than middle school, given access that kids have from such a young age to being able to be online, even with certain parental safeguards, how are you delivering that message so that hopefully, you know, they get it?
So in the conversations that we actually have with students, it's about translating the deeds that they do online into a personal face-to-face behavior. So, for example, if you go up to somebody, and this we do this in the class. We make them go up to somebody face-to-face. They don't necessarily know the individual, but they have to say something really, really mean to that person's face. Then we walk them through the emotions that they feel about that situation. So we try to make it personal in real life and just see how that actually translates into the online behaviors. But so those are more like the cyberbullying types of events. But related to hacking, you know, the kids really think it's a fun thing to do.
That's the point. As long as it stays compelling and fun and appealing, you're going to have, you know, kids doing it just for the sheer fun of it. And as you say, to be able to build street cred. We're coming up to the top of the hour in just about a minute. We're going to say goodbye. But I'm just wondering, just from Tyler and from Jake, too, if you have quickly a couple final thoughts for people that you want to make sure they walk away with from today. Tyler, I'll let you go first.
Absolutely. Definitely to prevent ransomware attacks, conduct backups, have a very reliable antivirus program. Always ensure your Windows updates are up to date. Always make sure that you have network connection awareness to what you're connecting to, and always use your computer defensively.
Using your brain, too. Go ahead, Jake.
So going back to, I mean, just kind of put a thing out there for Jody's thing. GenCyber is a great program. They do middle school and high school kids, and they have that face-to-face interaction. It's completely free. I mean, it's sponsored. We have Cyber Hui. We're sponsoring cyber camps. We do cyber camps for middle school and high school kids, and then that gives them the opportunity, the platform, to kind of gamify, to learn things, and to have a way to express themselves.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining me today for Town Square. Thank you to Jake Ross, to Tyler Rouse, and to you, Jody Ito, for joining us by phone from Maui. Hope it goes really well and that they get the message that it may be fun today, but it's going to be really dangerous tomorrow. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Thank you for joining us for Town Square. I'll see you tomorrow for The Conversation. Aloha.